Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Now there's extra money to help secure Florida's voting system, but is it enough?
These elections are marathons, they're not sprints. There will be other elections, and you want to make sure that money is available to supervisors in the future, that this isn't a one-time shot.
Also this week, are those in charge of the state's polling places fully equipped to recognize possible election meddling when they see it?
For those personnel, what would they need to know in terms of understanding the different types of threats and vulnerabilities?
We'll also learn how deep a budget shortfall is facing Florida's prison system, and we'll hear the argument that games of chance aren't gambling if you know in advance whether you've won or lost. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida's primary election is just a little more than 5 weeks away, so it seems timely that we kick off this Capitol Report edition with a couple of stories about voting. Election watchers are trying to avoid a repeat of 2016, when Russian hackers tried to gain access to networks across the country. They didn't get in, but it's a cloud that continues to hover over the midterm cycle. Lynn Hatter has more on that story.
Congress created a $380 million grant program this spring to help shore up election technology and security, and President Donald Trump signed off on it in March as part of a federal spending bill. The Federal Election Assistance Commission distributed the money to states, with Florida getting $19 million. State Elections Division Director Maria Matthews explains how the money can be spent. Allowable costs include post-election audits, physical security,
roll-up doors, or locked cages for ballots and supply materials, enhanced physical security and access control features like a fireproof door,
and cybersecurity. Matthews and Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner appeared before the Florida Legislative Budget Commission to get the okay to start disbursing the money to local supervisors of elections. Those officials had until July 18th to submit proposals for how they would spend the dollars. Detzner says each county will get about $50,000, with the rest to be distributed based on voting age population. The money comes in the wake of attempts by Russia to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. And Leon County Supervisor of Elections Mark Early says it's a recognition that election systems are becoming considered as critical infrastructure.
But this was really earmarked more for combating the potential outside threats from nation states and hardening our security environment as elections officials. It's along the lines of the elections industry becoming critical infrastructure. We take that very seriously. The threats are real.
Last June, it was reported systems in Florida, along with several other states, were targeted for hacks. Leaked documents revealed a Tallahassee-based firm was targeted as part of Russia's efforts to influence the presidential campaign. Hackers used a fake, malicious email from the company to try to gain access to more than 100 local government offices. During that recent budget hearing, Miami Democratic Senator Oscar Brainin inquired whether the money would have an effect on preventing future attacks.
Could you tell us in any way how they would have or would be put into use to stop what I guess came out a little while ago, that there were over 100 attempts to infiltrate our local election systems?
And Detzner reiterated that no Florida election information was compromised. Election supervisors are facing a tight spending deadline. They've got until November to use the money or lose the money. It would revert to state coffers. And Leon's Early says he's got uses for the cash, but
if I have to try and use all of it or else I'll never see it again, because Leon County has $231,221 allocated for our use. Miami-Dade's like $1.6 million. It's difficult to find wise uses for all of that to be rolled out in time for this election without disrupting your current infrastructure to a point where it causes more harm than good trying to change, you know, it's kind of changing horses while you're running a race.
Still, Detzner says there's a reason for the quick turnaround. Money that ends up going back to the state can go toward future tech upgrades. He says technology is constantly changing and systems have to be nimble enough to adapt.
These elections are marathons. They're not sprints. There will be other elections. We want to make sure. We want to make sure that money is available to supervisors in the future, that this isn't a one-time shot, that we can have longevity and learn from our best practices this year.
Floridians head to the polls for the primary on August 28th. The general election is in November. The League of Women Voters is asking for the spending deadline to be extended through December. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida's Department of State has asked one of the state's universities for help in safeguarding the 2018 elections. Dr. Iman El-Sheikh directs University of West Florida's Center for Cybersecurity. She's been essential in developing a curriculum that's used to train supervisors of elections and their staffs. El-Sheikh recently spoke with Ryan Daly of Florida Public Radio to talk about what went into developing that training and what election cyber threats look like in 2018.
Dr. El-Sheikh, thank you so much for, you know, providing some of your expertise and insight here. How did you get into studying and working with cybersecurity? And you know, going off of that, how have you seen the practice evolve since you got in?
Well, first, thank you for having me on. It's an honor to be talking with you and talking about this important topic. So certainly during my time at the University of West Florida, as a university, you know, we have been looking at topics that are increasing importance, and cybersecurity quickly rose to the top of our list during our strategic planning efforts. And so over the past several years, we have been expanding our initiatives in cybersecurity, including our educational programs, our research. So that's kind of how I've gotten more involved in the cybersecurity field. The exciting thing about it, to answer your second question, is that as we see, it is a quickly evolving and always rapidly changing field. So the threat landscape continues to evolve. And so for me, it's really about making sure that we stay, you know, not just one step, but two or three steps ahead of the curve, and working with innovators and, you know, collaborators across academia, government, and industry to bring together the best minds and the best practice models to solve solutions that'll keep our state and our nation ahead of the curve.
And speaking of our state, obviously, were involved in developing the curriculum, which the Department of State used for training supervisors of election and their staffs. You know, what went into developing that?
Well, we certainly looked at, you know, national best practice guidelines for cybersecurity, and specifically worked with the Department of State in terms of, you know, what the work, who would be involved and what kind of knowledge and information and skills they would need for elections, supervisors, what specifically they would need. So we made sure that the curriculum was very up to date, was very tailored for elections personnel, and also very tailored for Florida to the extent that's possible.
You know, what does an election staffer need to, like you say, vulnerabilities and threats? What sort of things do they need to be aware of in 2018? And what are the threats and what are the vulnerabilities, if you had to characterize them?
Well, certainly it starts with, you know, core, you know, topics, such as understanding kind of how cybersecurity impacts, you know, computers, systems, networks, and certainly critical infrastructure, such as voting systems as well. You know, in addition, it's a lot of foundational knowledge in terms of looking at, you know, what are the different types of vulnerabilities, as you mentioned, being able to talk about, you know, malware such as viruses or worms, being able to talk about web-based attacks such as SQL injections or spyware, being able to talk about phishing attacks. We've seen vulnerabilities, happen due to somebody clicking on a link in an email. So, you know, it comes down to kind of foundation knowledge that really everybody, I think, needs some level of. It's just a matter of how much in depth does that need to be.
And, you know, talking about different kinds of threats, you know, was this training more heavily targeted at addressing offshore cyber attacks or domestic or both?
I think it really focused from the inside out in terms of looking at within an organization, within an elections office, and within for those personnel, what would they need to know in terms of understanding the different types of threats and vulnerabilities? What would they need to know about, you know, how to protect data ensure the integrity of data? What would they need to know about resources that are available to them, whether Florida state resources or national level resources that could help them in their roles? Because they have very important roles to fulfill in terms of our elections process and system. And, you know, cybersecurity needs to be weaved into that at every level.
Well, Dr. L. Sheikh, that's about all I have for you for questions. I thank you so much for coming on with me today.
Thanks. Again, for the opportunity.
That's Dr. Iman L. Sheikh from the University of West Florida, speaking with Florida Public Radio's Ryan Daly. Still to come on Capitol Report, skyrocketing health care costs mean less health care for Florida prison inmates.
You don't cut opioid beds in the middle of an opioid crisis. That's kind of rule one.
Meanwhile, several other programs helpful to inmates across the state have also been slashed.
The time to take action is now. You know, the imploding of the Department of Corrections is an emergency facing the state of Florida, and it's time for him to take action.
A SunPass snafu has users racking up nearly 2 months' worth of unpaid bills.
I don't know how much I'm going to be paying. It's a mystery.
And what makes a slot machine a slot machine? That's the question before a Tallahassee appeals court.
Can it be operated? And everyone concedes this one's operated through the insertion of a currency. Can it award a prize? Again, not on dispute. And then the question is, how does this machine or device award that prize?
We have a few stories this week that involve money problems, specifically money problems in Florida's massive prison system. The privatization of Florida's prison health care system was supposed to save millions of taxpayer dollars, but as we hear from Julio Ochoa reporting for Health News Florida from member station WUSF in Tampa, the cost to deliver care to the state's 96,000 prisoners has instead increased over the past 5 years, up some $46 million this year alone.
As a candidate, Governor Rick Scott pitched the idea of having private companies provide health care to the state's prisoners as a way to save $1 billion over 7 years. But in the first 5 years, the cost has climbed from $278 million to $375 million. Privatization isn't the only cause for the steady increases, but some critics say the system is padding the pockets of some politicians and enriching the company that provides the care. Randall Berg is an attorney who represents prisoners who believe they were wronged by the healthcare system. He's sued the state multiple times to force it to follow a constitutional mandate to provide care to inmates. He says privatization is failing.
It's been atrocious. I mean, it's a terrible business model, and it just simply doesn't seem to be working.
At first, it didn't work for the companies either. One was fired by the state. The other, Corizon Health, walked away from its 5-year contract. It was losing about $1 million a month. Martha Harbin is Corizon's spokeswoman.
Finally, it just seemed to be, a situation that made more sense to walk away from.
One company, called Centurion, stepped in to take over the state's prison healthcare system. It had political connections and deep pockets. Since late 2010, state records show Centurion's parent company has given more than $1 million in campaign contributions to the governor and key lawmakers. Records show it also paid another $2 million to powerful lobbyists. Randall Berg, the prisoner advocate, says the money has an influence.
That seems to have ensured that privatization will continue in the state of Florida, regardless of whether it has been successful or not.
The Department of Corrections declined to be interviewed, but in a statement said political contributions did not influence the decision to go with Centurion. In the scramble to replace providers, the state chose Centurion over two other companies who submitted proposals. The contract included a built-in guarantee of a profit. Last year, with the initial contract set to expire, the state started the bidding process for a new prison healthcare provider. Centurion was the only company to step up. The state's former provider, Corizon, initially considered submitting a proposal, but the company was in the middle of a reorganization. Spokeswoman Martha Harbin says the existing provider seemed to have support from the state.
That can be one of the factors that we look at on whether we're going to invest the time and the energy to put together a comprehensive proposal.
Republican Senator Jeff Brandis agrees that a single bid was not good for the process.
We have one provider for the state, and that's something, kind of a rule of business that I've always learned, is you never just want to do business with one provider because something could happen.
And the St. Petersburg lawmaker says there's another problem. An aging prison population and rules that force prisoners to serve 85% of their prison sentences are pushing healthcare costs even higher. The solution lawmakers came up with this year was to cut drug treatment programs within the Department of Corrections budget. Brandis didn't agree with that.
You don't cut opioid beds in the middle of an opioid crisis. That's kind of rule one.
He'd like to see a more competitive bid process and rules that keep one company from controlling more than 80% of the prison healthcare system. But ultimately, he said, the state has a funding problem. Florida has 96,000 prisoners, but is providing money for only 86,000. And a portion of those prisoners are elderly and would qualify for Medicare or Medicaid if they were released. Brandis says curbing sentencing guidelines would shift a large burden off of Florida's taxpayers. For Health News Florida, I'm Julio Ochoa in Tampa.
So if it's costing a lot more to provide Florida's prison inmates with health care, are state government officials providing more money to meet that need? The state budget officially went into effect earlier this month. It includes Florida's prison budget, which led to prison officials cutting funding to programs helpful to inmates trying to transition back into society. While some blame the Florida legislature, others want to stop playing the blame game and move forward. In the first installment of her series, Sasha Cordner digs into what led up to this point.
Last year, Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones presented to the state legislature her agency's part in the governor's public safety budget for the 2018 legislative session. Taking up most of the public safety budget, the prison chief asked for millions to cover the cost of lawsuit settlements, maintenance repairs, additional staff, and mental health services. But after the legislative session, Jones said her agency had to make some major adjustments to make up for more than $50 million budget shortfall, mostly to take care of rising health care costs.
This keeps us in line with national standards and our constitutional responsibilities.
That's Jones speaking during the past legislative session about how providing health care to all inmates is a requirement by law, and she said as much during a May release of the prison's budget overview. Secretary Jones did not want to sit down for an interview at this time, and an agency spokesman referred to the overview instead. In it, prison officials describe why reducing reentry programming and substance abuse treatment for inmates and offenders was, quote, a necessary last resort. And the overview states the rising health care costs have not helped. Some top officials, including Governor Rick Scott, have expressed their disappointment over this turn of events.
In my budget, I've asked for, over the last eight budgets, I think it's almost $400 million more than what the legislature has funded. The process is I get to propose a budget, and then the legislature decides what they're going to put into it. The Department of Correction is working hard. Our recidivism rate is down. As you know, our crime rate is down. I'm disappointed the legislature didn't fund all of it.
You know, the time to blame, that's gone by. You know, the time to take action is now. You know, the imploding of the Department of Corrections is an emergency facing the state of Florida, and it's time for him to take action.
That's Thomas Griffin, the CEO of Transition House. It's one of the transition programs around the state that lost more than $1 million in funding due to cuts made by the Department of Corrections to make up for the shortfall. Griffin says it's time for the state's leaders to step up and take responsibility for what happened during the session.
The House of Representatives passed the original budget, which included all the money. The Senate, you know, passed a budget that did not include health care coverage for inmates. But then that went back to the House, and the House did ratify that budget. Then that budget then went to the governor, and the governor accepted it. And, you know, it's time to, you know, take the responsibility that, you know, a mistake was made and an oversight took place, and it's time to correct that. Because currently, as we sit here right now, the governor has $3 billion in what's called a rainy day fund that he can use to, at his discretion, to, you know, address emergencies that may arise in the state of Florida.
Some lawmakers have been working behind the scenes in search of a short-term solution with no luck so far. Meanwhile, a panel of Florida lawmakers met recently to discuss some additional changes they'd like to make to the budget. That includes funds for election security, medical marijuana, and homeless programs. It even includes more than $9 million in funding to pay to treat inmates with STDs. But missing from the Joint Legislative Budget Committee's agenda is how to address the prison agency's budget shortfall. Incoming Senate President Bill Galvano is a member of that panel. He says his hope is to take care of that issue next year.
Well, I think that's more of a next session budget issue. It wasn't a matter of just being able to reauthorize funds. And that when the contract was renewed and those fundings for those programs fell out, that was something that now had to get kicked into the next fiscal year.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
The Florida Department of Transportation, better known as FDOT, began upgrading its SunPass toll system on June 1st. Since then, SunPass users have been racking up charges, but not getting the bill. Now Gina Jordan tells us the state has stopped paying the vendor responsible for upgrading the system amid calls for tolls to be waived altogether.
The Maryland-based company Conduent State and Local Solutions was scheduled to finish work on the SunPass system by June 11th. More than a month later, the system still isn't fully operational. That's led to a backlog of millions of dollars in payments to be processed. Charges are accumulating for SunPass users, but the tolls aren't being posted to their accounts. And that's putting customers like Mike DeMauro in a bind.
It's like, I don't know how much I'm going to be paying. It's a mystery.
DeMauro lives in Orlando and uses toll roads daily as a food delivery driver. His employer reimburses him for the tolls, but he hasn't been able to show what he's been charged by SunPass since June 2nd.
It's hard because they're going to bill me probably all at once, and I'm probably not going to have the money in the bank account to do that.
FDOT says it's withholding all future payments to Conduent until the work is done. In the meantime, the state says it won't collect late fees or penalties from SunPass users. DeMauro started a petition on change.org asking state leaders to take it a step further.
I would like to see the tolls be waived for the SunPass customers and hold Conduent responsible for the tolls during the outage, because it's their fault, not the SunPass users.
Tampa Democratic Representative Janet Cruz sent a letter to Governor Rick Scott on Wednesday calling the situation unacceptable. She wants the contract with Conduent to be voided and asked that the state suspend tolls for users affected by the outage. In the letter, Cruz goes on to accuse FDOT of trying to downplay the problem, and she wants to know how Conduent got the $287 million state contract to begin with. Conduent has a history of problems in other states, much like what's happening in Florida now. We repeatedly reached out to state transportation leaders for comment, but none responded. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
Florida's unemployment rate remained at 3.8% in June. That's the same as it was in May, slightly below the 4% national rate. Figures released by the state today showed the state gained 14,300 jobs last month. There were 387,000 jobless Floridians out of a workforce of 10.2 million. Okaloosa and St. John's counties had the lowest unemployment rate at 3.1%, followed by Monroe and Walton counties at 3.2%. Hendry County had the highest unemployment rate at 7%, followed by Sumter County at 5.7% and Citrus County at 5.6%. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Tallahassee's First District Court of Appeal is mulling what makes playing a game gambling. Pre-reveal games are electronic games often found in bars. The state says they are illegal slot machines. But Regan McCarthy reports the game operators argue that can't be because the people playing know whether they'll win right from the start.
Pre-reveal games work a lot like slot machines. The player inserts money and a program randomly decides whether they'll win or lose. But Brian DiMaggio, the lawyer representing the game operators, says there's a difference.
It requires the user of the machine to press a preview button prior to playing. They don't have to play if they don't like what the preview shows. The outcome shown on the preview is the outcome one gets 100% of the time, and you can walk away at any time.
Judge James Wolf says one factor the court must consider is whether to base its decision on one game or a series of games.
I understand, and I'm a simple kind of guy here. It comes down to whether you can consider the entire course of play or one particular game, because their argument is one particular game is not a game of chance because you know what the outcome is going to be. Your argument seems to be you consider the entire course of play.
The state argues if a user is presented with a losing outcome, they're still enticed to keep playing because there's a chance the next outcome could be a winner. But DiMaggio says the case is based on playing just one game.
Factually, that's what you have here. You don't have to play additional games. You can walk away after the game. You don't have to commit any more money. And there's a statute that defines gameplay, 546.10, I think, that talks about from the time you put your money in until that's over and not having to commit any more money, that's a game play.
Daniel McGinn represents the state's Department of Business and Professional Regulation. He says whether one game or a course of play is considered is largely beside the point. Even in a single play, McGinn argues pre-reveal games fall squarely within the definition of slot machines.
The question is, does the machine or device, can it be operated, and everyone concedes this one's operated through the insertion of a currency, can it award a prize, again, not on dispute. And then the question is, how does this machine or device award that prize? How does it make the determination?
McGinn says that determination is made through a random number generator, or through chance, which he says means playing the game even one time is gambling. A previous court had ruled the games are illegal slot machines. That question is now awaiting a decision on appeal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at Rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.